Okay, thanks very much. My name's Tim Lomas. My job currently is as Principal School Improvement Advisor, responsible for curriculum development and workforce development with the Lincolnshire School Improvement Service.
Thank you very much. Could you give me a brief sort of introduction to your career and how you came to be involved with school history?
Yes. I suppose my history career started after I'd done a history degree at university. I then got a part-time lectureship plus research assistantship at what was then Teesside Polytechnic, where I did a doctorate in medieval history. As a result of that, I got involved in various history organisations, including the Historical Association. I then did a teaching degree, history with geography, subsidiary at the University of Kiel, before entering teaching. My teaching was done at a variety of schools in the West Midlands, largely in Shropshire, and that gave me involvement in all sorts of history initiatives. We trialled and piloted some of the early curriculum innovation, especially at A-level and GCSE. That gave me involvement in examining and assessment from early days. I then came to the notice of a group called the Teaching History Research Group, which was based, usually met in Cambridge, consisted of a mixture of the foremost teacher educators in history, publishers, exam officers, and I joined that in the early 80s, I think, and that I then came to the awareness of the HMI in history, and when they were setting up the National Curriculum History Working Group, I was known as a part of that, as a practitioner, had contributed to one or two of their publications, and I was asked to join that working group.
The microphones
for. Okay, yes. I then spent a number of years working my way up in the teaching profession. My last teaching job was at Ludlow School in Shropshire, and then I was fortunate to be appointed the advisory teacher for history in Shropshire. I did that for a couple of years. An inspector's job for history appeared in Lincolnshire. I was fortunate enough to get that. Again, that gave me involvement in the more regional and national scene for history education. And I gradually worked up to senior inspector and now principal inspector in the School Improvement Service.
It's a long career, isn't it?
I'm beginning to feel my age.
You mentioned some of this involvement with these innovative services.
Yes.
Is that sort of early 80s?
Yes, in fact, my first involvement was probably the very late 70s, within 2 years of starting in teaching. The school I was at, which was the Albury Wells School in Bridge North, decided it was going to take part in what was called the Pilot A-Level, the GCSE Pilot A-Level, being devised by the AEB. And we were one of the very earliest schools. We were actually still devising it. I was part of the curriculum group devising it at the same time as teaching it in the early days. And that had some innovative assessment as well, which gave me some of my first involvement in assessment issues.
So you're talking about coursework?
It had coursework, and the way that the coursework was assessed was through kind of banding descriptions, something that later formed quite a large part of the national curriculum. And in terms of the kind of philosophy of history, the skills of history, the sources of history, I would suggest that the AB673, as it was called, the History Pilot, was almost as innovative as the school's history project at GCSE for bringing it. That was A level, but of course the ideas were then adopted considerably later on. And the idea of doing things like personal research and dissertations, I think, influenced coursework and things like that quite considerably later on.
Who were the people behind those ideas? As you say, that was a very important influence in levels of response, wasn't it, to the national curriculum?
Yes, yeah.
Where was that coming out of?
I think it came, and I don't want to demean some of the innovative work done by some of the examples, as we're called in those days. I think it might link to something we talk about later, which was attempts to sort of broaden the appeal of history, to start to think new ways about the teaching of history, to offer something that was an alternative, and it gathered together a mix of different interests, people from higher education, people like John Nicol, who's still around, some of the textbook publishers, people like Ben Jones, who was active, main textbook writer when I was teaching, some innovative head teachers as well who wanted to be part of this, and a small group of us that were involved in the piloting of that and devising materials.
What do you think it was, a reaction against the old types of assessment, you know, the right four essays and 3 hours of recovery?
It was partly that. It wasn't just an automatic reaction against what existed. I think there was a recognition that if history was to possibly survive and thrive, it needed to broaden its appeal. It never was intended, A-level never was, of course, it never intended as something for lower attaining students. In fact, it was always quite rigorous in that sense. But I think in some respects it followed naturally from the attempts by Dennis Shemmelt and people like that with the Schools History Project to provide a rather different approach to history, where the students were acting more as historians, this was part of it.
That brings us really to that issue about history being in danger in the 1960s, early 70s.
Yes.
Was that something you were aware of then?
Yes. I think it was. But like all things, if I said the same today, I think the pattern is very variable. I think one of the things that stand out most for me is really how stable history's been in some respects. It's had everything thrown at it. I think it's under threat. For reasons external to it being history, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
And I can talk a bit further about that later on. I think it's been under threat amongst certain age groups. I've always think it's been on the defensive in primary schools for the last 40 or 50 years. I think it's been under threat, bizarrely, when the government and others get concerned about Britain's competitiveness in the world. I remember days when subjects like technology became central because technology was deemed to be a way forward in this country. I remember earlier days when modern languages was felt to be something that we needed to do, the science need. When we didn't win many medals at the Olympic Games, PE suddenly appeared. And of course, it's always been the problem of something has to give in an overcrowded curriculum. Dating back to the 60s and 70s, I think the crucial article by Mary Price, History in Danger, struck a chord. I think that's why certain initiatives appeared as a result of that. I think the HMI got concerned about it. I don't think personally it was ever in danger of disappearing, but I think it was in danger of losing some coherence and prominence. But so I think there were crises in the 70s, and I think when the national curriculum came in, it was going to go through some more torrid times without the national curriculum.
If it hadn't happened, do you think the national curriculum sort of saved it?
I'm not going so far as to say saved it, and I don't think it would have probably gone down the line of being as marginal or something like Latin. I don't think it was becoming a totally niche subject. It's not the classics, but I think it was going to be much more bitty, and it could be that there were going to be certain places that it almost disappeared. Without that sort of guarantee and framework, I think a consistent approach to it would have disappeared. I think initially the national curriculum did it a service in the sense of giving it some protection from the curriculum. I think, incidentally, it was also helped by a range of other factors as well.
Right. Well, I mean, I could tease out what those are.
Which yes, I'll probably talk about
it. Take you back to the GCSE, because I wanted to ask you about your involvement in the GCSE and whether you thought that had, you know, the design and planning of it had fed into the national curriculum.
Yes.
Were you involved in the GCSE?
Yes, I was. And of course, what one has to remember is that when the GCSE appeared, a lot of people were involved in curriculum and initiative in those days. The old CSE boards were involving a lot of teachers directly in ideas and initiatives. There were task groups all over the place. I remember being one of the first pilots, even before GCSE, for 16 plus, as it was called, and we were trialing that out and feeding ideas in. GCSE didn't just appear, various developments occurred. There was a time, for instance, when the national curriculum first came out, people often forget this, that it was the intention that history would be compulsory up to the age of 16 in the earliest national curriculum, which meant devising GCSEs for everybody at that time. So I was involved in curriculum design then as well. Not an easy thing to do in the context of the national curriculum, trying to cater for the whole age range and making sure that it harmonised with what had gone on in Key Stage 3, because they'd all have done it in Key Stage 3 and you needed a GCSE for everybody in Key Stage 4 as well. So the short answer is, yes, I was involved in that. One of the things which is quite interesting, I think, is that in some respects the powers that be, and I really don't know the full background to it, but the powers that be, in a sense, wanted not to use what I think they would have termed the establishment in the devising of the national curriculum. They interviewed some of the most prominent members of the establishment.
You mean by establishment, the history?
Yeah, the establishment. Yes, the top teacher trainers, the most well-known people in the history world. I think I'm right in saying that by and large, the group that emerged, of which I was one, would probably not have been recognised. We might have been on the way up, we might have been very good practitioners with ideas, but we would hardly have represented the automatic names, I think. And I think that was deliberate. Well, I'm fairly certain it was deliberate. We do know that I think it must have been Kenneth Baker himself, did interview quite a lot of members of the possible members of the history working group, and that included quite a few people who were very prominent in the history world at the time, but they were rejected from the final group. Now, I've got to be careful here because I don't know exactly why that was the case, but you just felt that what emerged at the end of the day was a very varied group, and in some respects a quite innovative group in some other respects, but they were almost as though they were starting from scratch again and developing ideas from there, and that's why the Historical Association, which I've always been proud to be associated with, and organisations such as that, the School's History Project, the big history organisations, were not represented on the original National Curriculum History Working Group. And even the Local Authority Advisor Services, I'd only just started as a Local Authority Advisor, the well-known names who were quite prominent were not part of the final working group.
So how were you selected then? How do you think that came up with your
name? I think HMI had quite a lot of influence. I wasn't originally a member.
No,
two of us were kind of seconded.
Yeah.
The other one was Chris Culpin, who later got involved in the Schools History Project, but wasn't especially at the time. He was a well-known textbook writer and curriculum innovator. I've been associated with the Teaching History Research Group. I've been associated with assessment, and I think they wanted somebody with assessment expertise. The other thing, and I genuinely believe that this was part of not what got me on, but kept me there. It was made clear originally that Chris and myself could well advise for part of the working group and then almost like a task to do, and then we'd disappear. But we both kept on for the rest of the working group. So we only missed about the first meeting or something like that. And I think one of the reasons I may have been kept on, but again, you speculate on these things, is that I was probably one of the few that had both a genuine interest and awareness of history right through from the age of five up through to the age of 16. My and beyond, in actual fact. My interest had always been beyond just the secondary. Most of the others on it had an interest in part of the school curriculum, and it did need people who just had, especially for progression assessment, did need somebody who at least had some awareness. By that time, I was already a member of, before it joined with the Historical Association, there was a group called the Primary History Association as well, and I was a member of that. Strong emphasis on the Northwest in those days, but it did cover the whole country. And I was part of that from fairly early days, so I had a primary interest as well as...
So that was just an interest? You weren't actually teaching in primary?
No. I've had spells where I've been involved. As an advisory teacher, I had to do quite a lot of work in primary schools. And quite a lot of the resources I was asked to do as advisory teacher were aimed. So I developed a lot of expertise. The paradox is that if I add up the amount of time I spent in primary and secondary schools throughout my whole career, I've probably actually ended up doing more in primary than I have in secondary. But I was trained originally in secondary.
So in terms of the assessment, the attainment targets were one of the crucial things.
Yes, that's right.
So your input was important.
Yes, it was. And I remember literally staying up all night to produce drafts of those. This is where I don't betray confidences. I've said this on many a public platform. One wouldn't have started from where we had to start from in a perfect world. We're very conscious, and this won't be just said for history, we're very conscious of the fact that conventional progressive levels 1 to 10 don't work very effectively for subjects like history. But of course, this had been devised originally for science by Professor Paul Black and for maths. We even had doubts whether they worked very effectively for science and maths, but they certainly didn't work in subjects like history. So part of what we had to operate was an impossible situation. That doesn't mean there's no such thing as progression in history, but the idea of just moving up through a series of levels was a very difficult concept. I think overall we squared the circle as best possible way to square the circle. We always told schools separately that they had to be treated with a great deal of care, that they had to be operated by not just taking them at face value and setting a whole load of meaningless tasks. We always provided a context to it, but unfortunately that message was never fully understood by large numbers of the teaching profession for a whole variety of reasons, not the least of which was the kind of guidance and training that was possible to have with the national curriculum.
I suppose there's so much that needed to be absorbed at the same time.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah. And I think the amount of national curriculum training varied tremendously. There were programs, there was some funding to run training. In primary schools, you can only feel sorry for people because these people had to just go one subject after the other. And some of them were attending over a short period of time several subjects. For some of them, the training could only be a sort of half day or day. So issues like the assessment and progression could only be touched upon. And of course, the other dimension with it is there was almost some built-in antagonism to the fact that big ring binders were emerging. Primary colleagues in particular didn't fit in with their way of thinking. People took it at face value. They didn't realise that large chunks of it were indicative or exemplars, and assumed that everything listed there had to be taught. The fact that there were something like 170 names or whatever of people, in reality, most of those names being suggestions, but people seized upon the fact that you had to cover all these people, and of course it was never like that at all. So I think the amount of support and guidance, despite the fact that the NCC produced guidance. Again, there was too much coming too fast. And of course, the best guidance is where you can work individually with people, you can do some planning together. And there was never enough time to do that sort of thing, I think.
So it's pretty difficult on the early stage. Can I just take you back to the working group?
Yes.
Was there any sort of debate or discussion within the group about whether you could, you know, really resist the attainment targets or, you know, change it fundamentally, or that was it? It was just there and you had to...
I remember more than one occasion where... and they did have... they had a lead officer from what must have been the DES in those days. They had the chief HMI, they had the chair of the working group, who was Michael Saunders Watson, and they had the DFES, somebody from the civil service, or anyway, and that was somebody for much of it, who was a relative of Kenneth Baker, anyway. Now, they're very nice people, you know, in some respects understood exactly where we were coming. They formed a kind of inner management group, and I know they had meetings separate to us, but they did point out time and time again, they said, it's up to you, you're the working group, you can write what you want, but if you do, it'll be rejected. that was a polite way of saying you can waste your time if you want on certain things. Having said that, it wasn't closed as much as that. There was an awful lot that was up for negotiation. Bearing in mind, which is often forgotten, I think, that much of the guidance was the advice to the chairman of the group, which was published anyway, on what the structure was going to be anyway. So there was a limited room to play for there. But, you know, there was guidance on things like it should take 7.5% to 10% of curriculum time. It talked about the structure of British history, some other aspects of content. So you were tied to a certain extent. But ideas like the history study units and the actual attainment targets, there was some flexibility and freedom as far as that was concerned. And people just drew on their expertise of a lot of stuff that worked. Strangely, although it was anathema, I suspect, to many in the government at the time, the school's history project philosophy was very influential in the history working group. I think many of us brought our experience with things like the A-level structure as well to the things like the pilot as quite influential. But the idea of combining skills, the concepts and the content, there was a lot of freedom as far as that was concerned as to what we put there. And quite honestly, I don't think if we hadn't shown a certain independence and we'd been led much more, we'd have had concepts like interpretations and things like that in the final version. It would have been much more content laden. And I personally don't know this, even though it was part of the working group, but the strong rumour, and it did permeate back to us, that Margaret Thatcher didn't like it at all, and all she thought we were going to give was a few landmarks of history. That didn't happen, of course, at the end of the day, so we must have had a certain degree of freedom and flexibility.
Were you influenced by the academic debate that was going on? You know, the academics from the university sector who were making pronouncements?
Yes, we did have regular meetings with all sorts of people. We would have inputs. We would have separate... weekends away, we had a Chatham House meeting, I remember, with some of the leading academics, and you realise how varied their views are as well, and what a lot of them were concerned with was a safeguarding history. But what pleased many of us was how much they were prepared to learn and appreciate what we were trying to do. There were others, whose names I won't mention now, who had very much a simplistic view that it would be the great stories of history, but that wasn't commonplace. And we were aware, of course, of the ongoing debate all the time. We were conscious, because we were fed these, that history generated more interest than other subjects in the national curriculum. The questions, as we were still doing it, were being asked in the House of Commons about various aspects. So we were aware of its sensitive nature. People felt very passionately about it, often without a full understanding of what we were trying to do. I think we came to accept that as that you can't please everybody all the time. Mm.
So what were your own expectations, and were they fulfilled at the end of it?
Our own expectations that were that there was going to be something that was going to have potentially some good, exciting history that gave scope for schools and individual teachers to use in a much more creative way than they perhaps thought at first. Two things happened. People never quite cottoned on to the creativity, so in that sense my expectations weren't fulfilled. Secondly, even before the ink was dry, it was undermined slightly. It was Kenneth Clark, I think, as Education Secretary, John McGregor, who, even as we were publishing, said that they were backtracking on making it compulsory in Key Stage 4, for instance. Mm-hmm. Now that, of course, causes difficulties. You plan something for 5 to 16 and then you take out it compulsory from 14 to 16, and it starts to destroy the structure a bit. So I think they chipped away at it. I think in some respects we were slightly perturbed by the amount of negative criticism from it, but I think that was a learning experience for us. I think anyone who's been on any task group or working group often gets quite disappointed by reaction, because sound bites. The press weren't over complimentary about the whole thing. But what I think most disappointed us was that some of these most prominent history educators, who were very nice people I'd worked with, had so much to contribute, almost decided they were going to adopt a negative comment. And I remember sharing many a platform with them, and they were very pleasant when sharing a platform with them, but they'd then write up something negative thereafter, as though the whole thing wouldn't work. And we'd made the comment that things like the level descriptions had to be treated with a great deal of caution, but then they write a major article on how they didn't work and things like that. Well,
I wonder if other members of the working group, did they express those sort of views to you as well? Did everyone feel the same about
that? I think, yes, they did. Some were more sensitive than others about this. I think in some respects we knew we were going to get a certain amount of pillorying, and unlike quite a lot of subjects in the curriculum, we knew that this was going to be broader, because everyone had a view on the sort of history that was being covered. The range of feedback we got was much broader than for any other subject, and of course that came from politicians, it came from educationalists, it came from the general public out there, and there were a lot of comments as far as that's concerned. I think in reality, I can't blame them, that quite a few members of the history working group, in a sense, went back to their day job thereafter, because they weren't associated directly with education. It was broad-based, which left probably a small handful of us, because it was our job, that we had to stay caught up in that sort of thing thereafter. But, and here is an important but, of course, what then happened, it passed with the feedback to a task group from the National Curriculum Council, mm-hmm. who had to work on things. I do have to say that the liaison between the NCC people and some of us who had been part of the working group was quite strong. I think it was stronger than people thought it was and should be. that it was meant to be at arm's length. But sometimes there was an opportunity to explain to them what was meant by it, and they in a sense just reinforced it a bit more and made it a bit more explicit. And in that sense, what finally emerged was reasonably pleasing to those of us that had set the original national curriculum up. What has happened subsequently with the Deering Review and everything else, of course, in some respects has been either chipping away because less time for the subject. But the basic philosophy, despite the fact that some people think that they've radically overhauled it, the basic philosophy is still there from the original working group. And from what I see of some of the proposals for the new Rose curriculum in primary, it bears in places remarkable similarity to the original national curriculum in terms of philosophy. There are changes, life moves on, and certainly the level of detail has been slashed. But there's that attempt to have a sort of balance is still there.
Knowledge, skills, and
that's right. And even within the knowledge, the balance between local, British, and a wider world dimension. There's still attempts to that to do that. The attempts to balance the political, social, and economic. You know, we came up with formulas at the time, like the PEST formula, political, economic, social, and cultural. Those dimensions are still there. They're there in the Key Stage 3 curriculum. The original concepts are largely still there. They tweaked a bit, but the idea of using evidence, the idea of causation, the idea of interpretations, new ones have gradually appeared, but they always were there to a certain extent, like significance. They're still, they've permeated all the way through. Now, in some respects, most of us on the original one are quite happy for people to say it's evolved, but we can feel a certain sense of satisfaction that some of those original ideas are still incorporated.
It's the attainment targets that have really been taken away, do you think?
Yes. Interestingly, one of the proposals I remember at the time, it wasn't a serious proposal because I knew it couldn't happen, was the merging of the attainment, the 10 levels, into the banding definitions, if you like, which I suggested best fit banding definitions should be introduced right from the start. That way, where it was best fit, that worked much better than individual statements. And I recommended that right from the start. It was clearly a no-go area for the first national curriculum. But what was quite interesting is that I picked up those ideas. That was a very feature of the AUB 673 that I'd been working on. That was banding definitions. And this is the last year of it. I ceased to be an A-level chief examiner this year, finishing with the A-level. Those banding definitions go with us this time. They've been introduced into the pilot GCSE thereafter, so they date back right from the earliest days, and they came into the national curriculum, of course, with the next rewrites after the statements of attainment. So it's the idea of progressive levels have moved from individual statements, which were always intended to be indicative and not taken at face value, into broader descriptions. So, and they still remain, but of course their status has never been high. The moment that history didn't require external assessment, the status both of those and history in general declined. It's never been a requirement in primary schools. You had to report a level at Key Stage 3, and of course there was no compulsory Key Stage 4 for history. So they never had that much significance.
There was never a SAC set for history.
Although I remember working, we set up the task groups to devise them. They awarded the contract to one of the awarding bodies to develop SATs for history, but they never appeared.
So I wanted to take you back to that bit you were saying about how many people, it's such a broad range of people who have felt it was important to get the national curriculum right in their own view.
Yes.
How do you think it had become such a live political issue at that time? Why would history attract so much more response than other subjects?
I think it's seen as being a political subject in that sense. Even when you're studying social history and things like that, I think there were strong lobbies over which people to include. There was the strong view on whether you presented the story as one of continual progress or problems or fights and battles. It was still a time when, you know, the communist world was not completely collapsed. In fact, that kind of collapse occurred as the national curriculum was coming to fruition. And I certainly remember strong views from some people why Margaret Thatcher herself wasn't listed as one of the people that had to be covered in the national curriculum at the time. And we knew that we had to tread very carefully, and I think I'm right in saying if we didn't completely, we made a decision that we were going to practically write out any living person from the national curriculum at the time. So people felt fairly strongly about the content. And then, of course, there were other issues. These was quite significant times, and towards the end of apartheid, some of the sort of social and cultural changes coming in, some of the discussions about the relationship with Scotland and Wales, Ireland still loomed large as an issue. There were a lot of sensitive issues which potentially impinged on the history curriculum. And of course the main issue is everyone wants their particular part of history included. And one of the most noticeable features, in fact it was the most noticeable feature, it was a standing joke amongst us on the working group, that the biggest single set of responses to our proposals was, there's far too much in it, followed by the next sentence, but you haven't included so and so. That's when the politics come in. And of course, the other issue were very sensitive issues. This was a question, certainly, that made us have to rethink or make explicit this issue. I think it was Greville Janner raising the question about the Holocaust in the House of Commons. And that was one where I remember all meeting one day, we discussing the issues, should we keep to our general view that we don't make it too much explicit and give people real option to leave it out if they really must, or should we make it explicit? In the end, we knew we were on a hiding nothing by not making that one explicit. In some respects, the majority of us would have been quite happy to see it there. That wasn't an issue. But they're the sort of things that had political influence. And I can't think there were too many more. But it was just associated with the history of things that were changing or mattering at the time. There wasn't the same controversy over kind of local history in quite the same way. It was the national history in particular, and which international countries were being covered. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah. It says it shows great faith in education,
and
says they believe that it's important.
Yes, we were pleased to see it and gave some status to history. And there was more than one commentator, including politicians, that wanted to make it the fourth core subject, along with English, math, science, including the education secretary at the time, including some of the media as well, who saw it as significant. We knew it was significant in that sense. We knew that under the Conservative government at the time, the Prime Minister would never accept that. But nevertheless, it was. We knew it wasn't going to be marginalised as a subject.
Well, were the statutory orders then, what you were saying, they weren't much as you expected in the end, everything went through as you expected?
Yes, I remember a farewell party, and that must have been John McGregor, party's perhaps the wrong word, and we all sat round and he gave a talk at the end, and most of it was very pleasant, thank you very much for all the hard work, there's a lot of good things in here, but we have decided not to make it compulsory to the age of 14, so in that sense, as to the age of 16, so we were aware that there were changes going on all the time. And of course the other dimension, and I can't remember whether this was at the farewell do, whether it occurred slightly... No, this occurred when the NCC were working on it. They suddenly defined history as stopping. Do you remember this?
Yes, 20
years. Yes, 20 years ago, which was completely arbitrary, of course. And I think many of us, well, let's say we would not have chosen to make that rule, because, quite frankly, one of the values of history is you link the present with the past, and it didn't make the subject irrelevant, but it took away something as far as that's concerned. A rule, incidentally, well, I don't think it ever was a rule. It wasn't compulsory over the last 20 years. But, of course, it's a bit, again, schools see this in the press, teachers see this in the press, and just assume that you're not allowed to teach anything for 20 years, over the last 20 years. But quite a few did.
It's just they weren't going to get an exam on the Dual Testament.
Yes, that's right, yes. But of course, by this time, they were hardly going to get an exam on anything, and I think that was part of the problem. And why we thought these were reasonably heady days is a couple of reasons, one of which, as we knew, it was a compulsory subject in the curriculum. Secondly, it was being inspected as such. These were early days for the Ofsted inspection process, and of course in the early days all subjects were inspected and history had to be taken seriously in schools, both primary and secondary. As a former Ofsted inspector, I remember regularly going in and inspecting the primary history and the secondary history. So it was given a prominence in the early days. It's a sad indictment, isn't it, that one of the things that protects it is the kind of fear that you're not doing it right. But what I will say in its favour is that enabled it to not be stillborn, if you see what I mean. It gave it, once schools had started to teach it and realised they quite enjoyed teaching it, even though they started to teach it because they knew they were being held accountable, because also there was money in budgets to buy new resources and things like that, there was a kind of status attached to it. And what was quite interesting is that it then, despite it becoming still an optional subject, it held its own at GCSE as a result of its sort of strength in primary and Key Stage 3. Don't think the teaching was outstanding in the early days, but compared with quite a lot of other subjects, it was relatively popular in schools. And this is one of the interesting things, and perhaps we want to talk about this later, but despite the views, in a sense, of the purists and a lot of people who wrote on it, teachers actually quite enjoyed teaching it, and the pupils enjoyed national curriculum history in some respects. And we might not have agreed with the way it was taught very often, but the idea that it had been the national curriculum had ruined history was not evidenced at all in many of the schools. I think teachers partly rose to the occasion, and also the national curriculum did offer scope for teaching some quite exciting history.
So an improvement in some ways on what happened before.
Oh, I think in many schools it was a definite improvement. The fact is, it was unbelievably bitty before. I think, the classic case that I always cite was the history in the primary school. When you asked them what they'd done, they muddled up history with natural history, and so they were looking at the history of owls and things like that. Mm-hmm. Owls on the riverbank. So they might have mentioned a canal and the owls, and that was the history. You know, there was no coherence to it. The idea of using evidence, source material, of an inquiry-based approach. The national curriculum did lead to an inquiry-based approach much more than had occurred before. Can I also praise some of the early publishers as far as this is concerned as well? Now, in reality, some of us involved in the national curriculum and some of the more free-thinking writers realised the scope here and produced some best-selling textbooks, which encourage much more of an inquiry-based approach. I'm not suggesting this was the best of the series by any means, but the Schools History Project, which was, I'm told, was in over half the schools in the country as a textbook, mm-hmm. very much adopted this inquiry-based approach and key questions and things like that, which have become quite a prominent part of history teaching since then, and has continued and is built into the recent Key Stage 3 revision.
What do you think about the Deering Review then? Was it sort of knee-jerk to it, or was it a major revision or Deering Review? Was it worth doing?
Well, there's a side of me that says these things are inevitable, just as in 3 years' time there'll be another one. And you know, the GCSEs and A-levels have a limited shelf life. It's a constant series of evolving. And of course, teachers were quite rightly pointing out that the curriculum was becoming overcrowded as new priorities emerged, and teachers were under pressure, it was the proverbial caught into the pint pot, and there was a need. The Deering Review was an attempt at some sort of rationalisation. I don't think the humanities benefited from this, and we've got to bear in mind there came a time closely linked to it, although this wasn't Deering, of course, where the national strategies came in. And the national strategies, of course, imposed the literacy and numeracy hours. And the moment that schools started to be judged on those, then the Deering flexibility, the opportunity for schools, if you remember, there was an opportunity for them to drop aspects of the national curriculum to achieve this, that history was never going to regain its former status. So in some respects, Deering was an attempt to tidy some things up, to clarify some issues, to make it appear more manageable, but in reality it was an opportunity to reduce history. And of course in some schools that's exactly what happened. Some schools though saw the opportunities and did some good work as far as Deering was concerned, but and this isn't me being cynical, but I could argue that they could have done that work in the earlier versions because that flexibility and freedom was there to do that sort of thing.
And 1999 has been another revision, hasn't there?
Yes.
A little bit more slimming down.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I'd forgotten that one. Yes, again, it's more slimming down to reduce it to a couple of pages of, and they reduce things like, they changed some of the terminology as well. So programmes of study looked at key areas and things like that, and reduced it to very little that was statutory, broad focus areas. And again, it each time looks as though it's a major slimming, it's just a more efficient way. I think I said earlier, the basic structure has not gone. And strangely, in some respects, the original idea of history study units of blocks, of depth blocks, or blocks of study, was one of the things praised at the time. It compared very favourably with geography, where they said they didn't really understand its structure or anything like that, and it was all over the place. And gradually, the single entity with content listed for the history study units has disappeared. But there still are statements, or the 1999 version was broad statements about what should be broadly covered. It just lacked the specific detail. Strangely, I was one of the few that was slightly critical of that concept of history study units because it tended to produce a sort of bitty understanding of history. They saw it in blocks. Mm. They didn't see the links and connections between the different blocks. It was taught as separate entities without those links and connections. And I'm pleased in a sense that there's been gradually a bit more encouragement to link bits of history, because chronology, the chronological understanding, has remained one of the single biggest weaknesses. People don't know where, or pupils don't know where things slot in. I don't think
that's really convenient, because it brings me to this question about whether you think that the national curriculum has led to a better understanding of history by children, but you're sort of saying yes and no.
I think I would say yes and no. This again is partly the cynic in me. There's one side of me says that children's understanding of history is potentially great, but has never achieved what they're capable of. I think pupils' ability to understand and answer historical questions disguises the fact there's no depth to the understanding. They learn to a certain extent the conceptual key ideas, if you like, and can regurgitate them. And I don't think I'm just being cynical about it. I think I have evidence, even at A level, where, interestingly, after 10 years or whatever many years it is of being introduced to the national curriculum, GCSE, where they cover concepts such as evidence and the ability to criticise evidence, and they become reasonably good on paper at evaluating evidence, and they come to A level sometimes because the context is different, they still accept it at face value. There's no, it's not embedded in their culture and their way of thinking. Having said that, there are gains. The idea of teaching conceptually content and some of the skills has worked. They do have some awareness of some of the sources of evidence and how history is constructed. They do remember the opportunities which the national curriculum gave and encouraged them to get out into the field, to see history, try it out using ICT, visual forms of history, those sort of forms. Have left a more lasting impression on some of them. They do remember chunks of history. Although there's no coherence to what they remember very often, there are episodes from history that in some respects were much better than existed in many schools in the 70s. So I think there have been some gains. But I think the idea of a historical consciousness, despite the fact that they start at the age of five, and many of them will still be studying it at 19. Well, the fact that when they go to university, some of us had to start again almost in... to give an illustration, my first real awareness of what a historical source was in my day really came when I was doing a special subject at university. I really didn't at GCSE and A-level. I wasn't introduced to the raw material of history. So in that sense, things have moved on considerably. The ability of some students to put together historical discussion and express some viewpoints, I think, is rather better. You know, I learned a tremendous number of facts to pass my GCSEs in those days and A-level. But I don't think there was any sort of ability. I knew how to answer an A-level essay question, but I don't think I could have stood up in a debate and engaged in a sort of class argument, which some of them can do now. I think there's better quality debate in a lot of classrooms. And I think there's more personal autonomy. One of the things that pleases me, and it's quite a humbling experience at times, where people genuinely, even from sort of working class estates and whatnot, go back go and do some oral history interviews with their families in the evening. I don't remember that sort of thing when I was at school, going through my grammar school and things like that. It just didn't exist, I don't think. So you know, there are gains.
Also, this issue about the chronology,
yes,
is the loss.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the losses. Although one wonders, in a sense, how embedded that chronology was. I think we had an overall map of the past, which was many episodes soon forgotten, of course. And I certainly remember teaching A-level history in the later 70s. And still finding students who went to university to do history weren't sure whether the Tudors came before or after the Romans. You know, even though they'd been taught all those things, they couldn't remember because of when they'd been done and the order in which they'd done things, where exactly they belong. So again, I'm not looking back to halcyon days, but I think if anything, because of the structure of the national curriculum and, let's be honest about it, in some schools the amount of time and the gaps between studying history and even in the secondary school, some of them looking at history through more integrated thematic approaches, where things slot in, I think remains a challenge for them. But of course there are other ways of teaching chronology than just teaching things in a sequential order, and some schools are very good at giving them a sense of chronology and a map of the past. I also, I don't want to appear churlish as far as this is concerned. I've always been a strong believer that a good knowledge of history requires a reasonable general knowledge to see where some of the issues fit in. For instance, it needs a knowledge of geography. You can't have a sense of causation unless you know the kind of spatial relationships between countries and things like that. And I think it's down to, you know, little things like it becomes much more difficult these days for students to study both geography and history because of option blocks, and it gives them, it takes away something, I think. I'm not suggesting it should be made compulsory necessarily, but things get in the way of having that broader general understanding. I think one of the things that disappoint me greatly, because I'm a firm believer in history being a community subject, is how little a lot of students know, right through the age range, of their local community and the background to their local community. I don't think it's ever been that good, but I do remember many primary schools had, as part of their curriculum, before National Curriculum Days, things like local studies and things like that. And I remember doing exams even at primary school called local history, where there were questions and quizzes on the locality. It's just that opportunity to acquire a broader knowledge. And, you know, it's not the fault of the current education system, because there's so much else that competes for its place. But I think they've lost their understanding of history a little bit as a result of that. And dare I say, for some of them, the lack of inquisitiveness. I think that is a slight issue. And this is, again, just not always a history issue, but many pupils do not read for pleasure. Many of us went and bought the Lady Bird book of something or other and worked through Lady Bird books and things like that when we were young. We got them at a library and things like that, but they're reading for pleasure. I think there's quite a lot of evidence now that a lot of students, although it's not hopeless, it's not a dramatic decline, don't read for pleasure. They won't be attracted to a book in the library with pictures of historical events. Some do, you know, and some of them do watch the history programmes on television, but it's I think we've lost something about their broader awareness. So the chronology issue isn't just the fact of the teaching, it's the broader society thing as well, I think, and where things fit in.
I wanted to ask you a bit about assessment, actually, particularly because of your expertise on that. I mean, I found going back through the records that history teachers have always complained about the effect assessment has on that, you know, final 2 years.
Yes.
That happened under O-levels,
yes,
GCSEs.
Yes.
Do you think it's sort of inevitable? Is there any way of having an assessment system which doesn't sort of
happen? I'm not sure I do. I do a lot of training on assessment. I've been all over the country. In fact, I've been outside this country as well to talk about assessment. I usually start my talks by saying, I'm not going to be popular here today. And in reality, you have to point out that it's often time-consuming. The teachers don't want to do it. The pupils don't especially want to do it. The evidence from the researchers suggests that a lot of it doesn't work effectively, so you're partly on a hiding to nothing. I think there is a danger between, or there is, sorry, there is a difference between a kind of progression and monitoring progress, which I think is perfectly doable, and most of what counts for assessment today. I actually think that the post-14 assessment, the GCSE assessment, has had a slightly too bad a press. I don't think it's quite as bad as some people make out. And in some respects, some of the assessment processes have been quite innovative. Some of the best innovation has come, I think, from GCSE. And of course, the one I would cite is the current pilot scheme, which is influencing history for the future. And like I've already mentioned, the A-level assessment as well. And the idea of levels marked schemes and things like that started off with GCSE or GCE and the school's history project. So there has been some innovative assessment post-14. And I think part of the problem is that I think there is an understanding of effective means of assessment in history. What many have done is simply set single assessment tasks, whereas all the evidence suggests, of course, that pupils gradually reinforce an understanding by applying things in lots of contexts. Now that makes conventional assessment methods quite difficult in reality, and certainly the concept of fixed statements and hierarchies when in reality the hierarchy is just about reinforcement and embedding, is quite at odds with a progressive 10-level structure. So I think there are challenges as far as that is concerned. In some respects, the most effective assessment is where it's done in a variety of contexts, a variety of time, testing them not just in written formats, but orally, perhaps in field work, their ability to contribute in groups, that variety over a period of time is notoriously difficult to do, of course, and without proper training and thinking, most teachers do not either have the confidence or the inclination to go down that line.
That seems to be always the way. So you have this group of enthusiasts who do things wonderfully.
Yes, yeah.
But then when it's rolled out to everybody, of course, it's not their passion.
No.
You've got to provide something which is an easy to handle vehicle.
That's right, yes, yes. And actually, that explains the national curriculum. It is clearly laid out and it's relatively easy to understand, when in reality it's that there's a whole complexity underneath it, and that applies to the numeracy strategies and the literacy strategies and things like that. There was the potential to do quite exciting things underneath it, but it's laid out in such a way that it looks quite mechanistic, formulaic and simplistic. History assessment always was possible in an exciting way, but it was only possible if teachers stopped teaching more or less and concentrated on spending all their time thinking of effective assessment methods.
Yeah.
And you know, teachers are busy people, and I think the pressures and of accountability have not encouraged risk taking and innovation, and I think that's probably one of the greatest disservices, which has nothing to do with the national curriculum. It's just the fact that if you fail Ofsted, if your results aren't good, you get sacked. If you are not very innovative, you don't get sacked. So you know, most teachers, not surprisingly, go down the line of keeping their job, still reasonably entertaining the pupils. We find very few instances where pupils actually say they hate history. You know, in that sense, there's a lot achieved, and that's one of the progresses. Not just the national curriculum, but good teachers coming in, making reasonable use of the national curriculum, have helped.
Good. When you at the conference, and you mentioned it already, the new pilot GCSE with a sort of heritage and
yes, that's right, a more vocational way.
And then it's got this contemporary significance issue, haven't
it? Yes, that's right. Yes.
So
yeah.
Where have the ideas for that to come from? As you said, you know, significance. You see, it wasn't exactly mentioned in the, but it's sort of there. I mean, how
yes.
has that emerged?
There's actually been a reasonable amount of consensus as far as this is concerned. What happened was, I think the original impetus came from the QCA, who gathered together the broader history community. So the archaeological community gathered together, there were representatives from English Heritage, and they started to thrash around ideas. The trouble is, when you start thrash around ideas and blue skies thinking, sometimes it doesn't lead to a specification. But people started to say, wouldn't it be nice if there could be something a little bit more that seems to have a relevance? The idea of vocation, of course, has been around for some time now. It isn't just the diplomas, it's before the diplomas. And to start to think whether there was an opportunity for history to have that dimension, bearing in mind it wasn't in a vacuum. Similar thinking was going on in geography and one or two other curriculum areas as well. Even then, I think there was a feeling that it was a series of ideas which needed translating, and of course the tender then went out for one of the awarding bodies to devise something, and the OCR, I won't say won the contract, because they may have been the only ones who tendered for it, and it got together a small group of us who'd been a mixture of the exam world, but also to a certain extent being involved in innovative things over a period of time. And in truth, four of us largely wrote those specifications for the pilot. Colin Shepherd, who had been the leader in a sense of some of the innovative national curriculum textbooks about inquiry-based approaches, had been the school's history project chief examiner for some time. Chris Culpin, who'd been with me on the original National Curriculum Working Group, associated with SHP, again a prolific author, been associated with curriculum innovation in several ways. Myself, Rosemary Rees, who was a chief examiner for EdXL, written quite a lot of textbooks, I've been an exams officer in the past, and together we started to kind of make it more like an exam structure, but keeping some of this innovation, but still drawing on the fact that the archaeological community or the media wanted inputs in that, and so using some of their ideas to put them into a consistent form. And quite honestly, the thing was put together quite quickly at the end of the day. I remember two or three weekends where we then assigned the work to each other to write up the specifications, and we all did chunks each, came back together and looked for consistency. And it had the blessings of the QCA, who approved these sort of things, which was quite a lot of backwards and forwardsing. But we had the opportunity to be innovative. To put together something, because it was called a pilot, you didn't have to go through quite the same rigours. And, you know, there was a goodwill, the geography was going through at that stage. So it was a cumulative effort from those who had to put it together in final form to a lot of people contributing at various stages throughout the process. Those powers that be not standing in the way, really, because it's so easy for them to stand in the way. It's got to fit a formula. It still had to fit within a certain context. But we were amazed how much of a gamble they were prepared to take, because it is so totally different in terms of assessment, for instance, in terms of content to what exists before.
In terms of assessment, what proportion is
70% is and even the other 30% is done within classroom conditions. Well, it's supervised classroom conditions. They get the assignment and they're allowed to go away and then come back to it next lesson and things like that, and they're allowed to take resources in there. So in that sense, it's quite innovative.
Dare I say, it's a bit like
Mode 3 CFC. Some aspects, really. Yes. I don't think it's any easy option. And in fact, some of them have found it very demanding, in actual fact. Paradoxically, greater flexibility can make it more difficult for large numbers of students. And the fact that it is more difficult to be trained in the techniques and formulas is especially difficult for many. When you see some of the responses, they look crudely written sometimes, and you think this is of a lower quality, until you realise the quality of the thinking is probably better, because they've been made to think, and there's a certain crudeness there in their thinking, but it's their thinking, whereas a lot of what's regurgitated in coursework in conventional GCSEs or in the exam sometimes is quite mechanistic.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that as the pilot as something that is going to influence the pattern of the next phase of GCSE history then?
There's a general feeling that it ought to. I say general feeling, there will be a large number that still think we should be teaching the Plato to NATO approach. But all reports and research into it, and admittedly at this stage, these are still early days, have been complementary. Having said that, there's still a lot that we need to sort out. What we don't know is how much national consensus there is for this. We've got the aficionados, in a sense, doing it. We've also got a small number who think they ought to do it because they haven't been very successful with their current history. It's opened up now to 100 centres, but what are there, 2,000 or 3,000 secondary schools in this country? So there's a long, long way to go as far as that is concerned. And in that sense, it may be not going to influence everything, but exist in parallel, you know, different ways of doing things. And of course, we've got the diploma, and the relationship between that and the diploma is going to be an interesting one as well as things emerge.
So it brings me on to the last question, really, about your view of the sort of current position vis-a-vis diplomas, party political views.
Yes, it's interesting on the diploma. The humanities diploma looks slightly out of place, I think, and I think there is a general recognition that the academic diplomas, in a sense, invariably there's some conflict with things like pilot and indeed GCSEs generally, and you know, an academic diploma will have a certain amount of overlap with conventional GCSEs as well, and the problem of work-based learning and things like that with diplomas are always going to give it some challenges. I would like to support the idea of the diploma for the future, but two things. A, there could be political decisions made about this, and I think there's every chance that it won't exist in its existing format for very long. And secondly, even if it does, it becomes very difficult to know what the market is for this. I can't see a massive market for the humanities diploma. There are many other diplomas which may well take off if they're allowed to continue. But the humanities and the science ones and the language ones, I do have some doubts. I'd like to think that there would be a market, but it's a bit like the pilot. I suspect at the end of the day, if they survive, there'll be small scale things. So I don't think there'll be the natural way forward in the history area.
So what is the sort of natural way forward, do you think?
I think there's a mixed economy as far as history's concerned. I think there will be more flexibility in the future. You know, there's increasing pressure, for instance, for the international GCSEs to have a place. There will be a number of schools that decide that's the structure, very traditional in some ways. Some of the formats with the existing GCSE will come to pass. There will be new programmes which are more integrated that incorporate a history dimension. There may well be some diplomas as well. I think there'll be more choice and modular structures and mixing and matching for the future. Or indeed, and this is still an option for the future, depending on things like school leaving age and the expectation that people will stay in the in some form of full-time educational work till they're beyond 17, is there a need anyway for a terminal exam at the age of 16? So there's a lot to fight for, I think, as far as this is concerned. And I think, let's be honest about it, in subjects like history, we've always been used, certainly throughout my professional career, I suppose 30 years, where it's kind of, for most of that time, being on the defensive and reacting to changes all the time. I think history, in a sense, is quite good at that sort of thing and adapting. I think it's had to. It's been the one thing about optional subjects like history, and I wouldn't lose sight of the fact that in many schools it remains the most popular of optional subjects despite all that's being thrown about it. It's quite resilient in that sense. If you're a subject like English and maths, you haven't had to be quite so versatile as far as that dimension is concerned. So I think it's ready for the next stage in its battle. I think the quality of history teacher is still very, very high, if not higher than it's ever been. So there's good practitioners out there ready to make a good fist of what we have to offer. But you know, the one lesson you learn about history is when you think you can predict what the future is, you've made a mess of history.
Thank you very much.